present the third episode of Pay Any Price by Ted Albury, which he's adapted from his novel of the same name, with Barry Foster as Jimmy Boyd, Robert Beatty as Otto Schultz, Susanna Fellows as Debbie Shaw, and Michael J. Shannon as Tony Simmons. Pay Any Price.
Jimmy Boyd had got a call that the new car he had ordered was waiting at the local dealer's. So we had gone down and we were both listening to the salesman giving the usual spiel.
The radio stereo with four speakers and with the hood down, it's even better. Mm-hmm. Now there's a station-seeking device on it. Here, let me show you. Just press the red button like this.
Yeah.
There. Mm-hmm. And if you want to change it...
She commented on Jackie's lovely dress.
Oh, there.
And suddenly we heard a reverberating explosion.
Hey.
My first thought was not to look at the president. I guess the thought that anybody would take a shot at the president of the United States didn't even go through my mind at the time. I didn't realize at the time that he had been shot and was slumping.
We'd better get right back, Jimmy.
Okay, I'll follow you, Otto.
2 hours later, we heard that John F. Kennedy was dead. It was like a great black cloud settling over the whole United States. It didn't seem possible. Within hours, we saw on TV the insignificant figure of Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement of Dallas Police Station and the journalists asking him questions.
I positively know nothing about this situation here. I would like to have legal representation.
What happened in the courtroom, Lee?
Well, I was questioned by a judge. However, I protested at that time that I was not allowed legal representation during that very short and sweet hearing. I really don't know what this situation is about. No one's told me anything except that I'm accused of murdering a policeman. I know nothing more than that.
What about the president?
I do request someone to come forward and give me legal assistance.
Did you kill the president?
No, I have not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
And as if that wasn't enough, a few days later at the same police headquarters in Dallas, a police officer was making an announcement to the press that Oswald himself had been shot and killed.
The suspect's name is Jack Rubenstein. I believe he goes by the name of Jack Ruby.
And there was a strange TV interview with Jack Ruby in an empty courtroom after one of the many hearings concerning his shooting of Oswald.
The only thing I can say is everything pertaining to what's happened has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred. My motive, in other words. I am the only person in the background to know the truth pertaining to everything relating to my circumstances.
Do you think the truth will ever come out, Mr. Ruby?
No. Because unfortunately, these people, who have so much to gain and have such an ulterior motive to put me in the position I'm in, will never let the true facts come above board to the world.
Jack Ruby was the Jack Rubenstein John Kennedy claimed had murdered a union official in Chicago and let the mafia into the Teamsters Union. And the same Jack Rubenstein who got Santos Trafficante out of jail in Cuba. There was a short TV interview about this time. I think it was a team from the BBC. It was with William Alexander, Assistant District Attorney of Dallas, who had attended the police interrogation of Lee Harvey Oswald.
What were your impressions at the interrogation, Mr. Alexander?
I was amazed that someone so young could have the self-control that he had. It was almost as if he'd been rehearsed or programmed to meet the situation that he found himself in. It was almost as if he anticipated every question, every suggestion, every move that any of the people in charge of him made.
Rehearsed? By whom?
Well, who knows?
Then a very strange thing happened. Dorothy Kilgallen was a freelance journalist with a syndicated column. She had just come back from interviewing Jack Ruby in his cell, the only journalist who was ever allowed to interview him. When she got back to her apartment, a friend of hers, a fellow journalist, called around to see her. He said later that she had paced up and down her room, a glass in her hand, trying to control her excitement. When he pressed her to tell him more, she stood quite still, turned slowly to look at him, and said, and I quote her exact words, "What Ruby told me this afternoon is going to blow the JFK case sky high." She refused to tell him any more. Later that night, with her apartment a shambles, she was dead. Dead from a massive overdose of sleeping pills laced with alcohol. And the missing pages from her notebook added to the mystery. It was a standard reporter's notebook with a spiral binding. 130 pages where there should be 150. The transcripts of her interview with Ruby had been removed. Her death was registered as suicide. Somebody once said that drama in a play was when somebody died, and melodrama was when everybody died. The president was dead, Oswald was dead, Dorothy Kilgallen was dead. Of the mafia men, John Rosselli's body was soon to be dredged up from the ocean off Miami. His corpse had been crammed into an oil drum by sawing off his legs. Hoffa, the Teamsters' leader, disappeared and has never been seen since. Everybody connected with that meeting at the Fontainebleau in Miami is dead or has disappeared. Witnesses to even minor aspects of the Kennedy assassination died prematurely and mysteriously. There were two other meetings that you should know about. Debbie Shaw had had another abscess in her throat. She had phoned the Washington number, and Simmons had flown across to the U.S. Army camp just outside Annapolis, where she had been performing.
How long has your throat felt like this?
A week, but the real pain started yesterday.
Okay. I'm going to give you some capsules. Take one every 4 hours today and tomorrow, and I'll come and see you the next day.
I won't be able to sing by Saturday, will I?
You won't be singing for at least another month. This is worse than the first one you had, and it's in almost the same place.
You sound very stern and cross.
I am stern, but I'm not cross. Now take those capsules, one every 4 hours. No messing about, or I will be cross.
It took 7 weeks for the abscess in Debbie Shaw's throat to heal, and in the process, she lost the little girl voice and ended with a deep, husky voice that would have made her a fortune as a singer, except that the narrow range of her new voice made singing out of the question. When it was finally obvious that her career was over, the doctor helped her make a claim for compensation from the U.S. Army. After pressure organized by the doctor, it was eventually settled by paying her the full balance of her contract, a sum of $9,700 U.S., plus an ex gratia payment of $11,000, no medical charges, and free transport back to England. What I've told you so far all happened in the United States, but the second event was going to change all that. Grabowski, remember him, had ordered his stooges Simmons and Peterson to a breakfast meeting at Cheryl's Bakery in Washington. They had got to the coffee stage before he said anything that mattered.
Yeah, well, they've decided it's not safe for you two to be around for the next 6 months or so.
Why not?
Oh, too many people raising hell about the Warren Commission's findings. You know, all sorts of investigative committees are being set up. Some official, some not. But all of them looking for blood. CIA and FBI blood, preferably.
What's that mean, Ziggy? Mexico?
Nope. Pardon me. You'll be going to England. You won't be so noticeable there.
What are we going to do?
Our people have rented a house for you up in the north, near the border with Wales.
Wales isn't north, Ziggy. It's west.
Well, what's the name of the other place, then?
Scotland, Ziggy.
Yeah, that's it.
And what do we do?
Well, they want you to do a report on all your work and thinking. The theoretical stuff with all those kraut and Latin words and all the practical stuff. And when you've done that, We'll see what else we can find you.
Yeah, it sounds like whitewashing stones at boot camp.
That's what you're going to do, my friends. Nobody's asking. It's an order.
Who's giving the order, Ziggy? Was it Helms?
You'll get full overseas allowances, the accommodations, and upkeep will be on the house. And it'll all count for your seniority.
In that case, when do we go?
Tonight. You booked on a flight to Prestwick, which they tell me is the nearest airport.
Now, hell, Ziggy, I've got things to arrange. We both have.
We're going back to Langley right now. You can both of you tell me all the things you want doing, I'll get them done. But neither of you goes back for anything.
What about clothes and passport?
You'll have an allowance for buying clothes out there, and you'll be having new passports. Canadian ones. New names, new IDs.
Would Mr. Morrison, meeting passenger Harvey on Air Canada?
There's an envelope here for each of you. You'll find details in there with two telephone numbers. The first of them for routine communications, but only when it's really necessary. The second is for a real emergency. You'll be contacted every 2 weeks, and you'll be under surveillance most of the time.
Are there any restrictions on travel?
You'll find the ground rules in your envelopes. You don't talk to anyone except social chit-chat. And you don't reveal your real identities or your status. Not to anybody.
By the time all this was going on, Debbie was back in London running her own theatrical agency. Doing very well, it seemed. It wasn't until much later that I learned from Jimmy Boyd what happened in England. I'll leave it to him to tell you about it. Neither of us knew anything of what had been going on apart from what was public knowledge. We were both occupied with our normal duties.
I enjoyed my work with Schultz and the others at the CIA. They'd offered me permanent employment, and I'd seriously considered it. But the assassination of Kennedy made me back off. Well, I took my deferred leave in London, and that was a lucky break for me. In the third week of my leave, I met Katie Mallison. It was pouring with rain, and I went into the gallery to get out of the wet. Katie was an artist, and the gallery was putting on her first one-man show. The PR girl thought I was from the press and introduced me to Katie. Well, I talked her into dinner that night. She wasn't just pretty. I've had plenty of pretty girlfriends. It was as if we'd known one another for years. I dated her every night for a week. And at the weekend, she'd driven me down for lunch with her parents in Sussex. We had dinner alone that night in a country pub on the way back to town.
I agree that he's rather too camp, but he is a good artist. Maybe the camp bit and the talent go together.
I'm sure you're right. Will you marry me, Katie?
You don't have to marry me to get me into bed, James. We can do that tonight and no strings. Oh, you're blushing. The first time I've ever made a man blush. Well, I won't ask you if you've thought about marriage. I know you'll have thought a lot before you spoke. I've thought about it too. Days ago.
What did you decide?
To say yes. Provided you accepted that my painting means a lot to me. I earn my living by painting. I make a reasonable amount of money, and I care about my exhibitions and all that jazz. I always thought that if I married anyone, it would have to be another painter, but I think I was wrong. You don't know a damn thing about art, but you do encourage me. You sit there quietly in my studio while I paint, and you just read, or you're just watching, and I feel nice and safe. So, yes, I'm flattered that you ask me. And I'd be very happy to marry you.
One of the benefits you have working for the establishment is pulling strings when you need to. I got Healy, my boss at SIS, to use the old boy network to fix a special license. And Katie and I were married at Chelsea Registrar's office with a cleaning lady and a taxi driver as witnesses. We drove down to Chichester for our honeymoon and spent all our time at the pretty little villages that are dotted round the creeks. And on the last day, we bought a second-hand 27-foot Seamaster from a yard in Bosham. 2 days later, she saw me off at Heathrow. And when they called my plane and she stood waving through the plate glass window, I felt lonely for the first time in my life. I was going to miss my Katie. Although I didn't know it, somebody else was about to do the journey in reverse. Simmons and Peterson were setting off for Prestwick.
One of our people will be meeting your plane, and he'll take you to the house.
I want you to make it clear back at Langley that I go under protest, Ziggy. It's going to be a waste of my time, and I resent it.
You just do as you're told, my friend. You're going because that's what Langley wants. We're not playing games, you know, Simmons. But keep your nose clean, and you'll be welcome back in due course.
Sounds almost like a threat, Ziggy.
You're right, old friend, it is. Okay, you better go on board. We're holding things up.
That's Bamborough Castle. Kind of spooky, huh?
How long before we got to the house?
20 minutes. Maybe a little more.
What's the name of this dump?
We're heading for Alnwick. But they spell it A-L-N-W-I-C-K. You'll see the castle on the left. It's a family seat of the Duke of Northumberland.
You seem to be well informed. You're based up here?
I'm based in Marlow, town on the Thames. I get around.
About a year later, my assignment in Washington came to an end. Katie had spent the last 4 months with me. She liked the States, but was glad we were going home. I was to be based in London for a couple of years, and I'd had a promotion for mending some of the bridges with the CIA. I was going to handle those assignments that need unraveling before you can decide what to do about them. Well, I'd been back about 6 months when one of those landed on my desk. As it turned out, it must have started just before I got back to London. I'd never heard of Grabowski then, but SIS had its own Grabowskis. This particular one was a chap named Carter, tough, ruthless man, who ran a team that dealt with things that the top brass didn't want to know about, but were glad to have done for them. Carter's thing started when he briefed one of his chaps, McLaren.
I said 11 o'clock, not 11:15.
Yeah, I got stuck in the crowds around the palace for the changing of the guard.
And more fool you. Where do you want to go?
Up to you, Chief.
Well, we go in here and have a coffee.
Okay.
I'm giving you Sturges for a surveillance job.
Oh, God, I hate those jobs, Chief. They're not our style. We're wasted hanging around.
It won't take long. Now, that's the guy's name, and that's his address. He's a Yank. Been living in this place at Marlow for a couple of years. About 6 months ago, he got himself a girl. And she works on the sweet counter at Woolworths. She's 20 and been hopping into bed with him regular. She told her girlfriend that this guy's been shooting a line with her about being a CIA man. Her girlfriend's husband is a local copper. She told him about this guy, and he passed it on. It's probably just the usual crap, but look him over and let me know. Okay?
When do we start?
Right now. Sturges is at his usual number.
Did you get the thermos filled?
Yeah. Is she in there?
Aye. They drove up about 11. Been in there half an hour. And that fits in with her old man being on the night shift. I wouldn't mind that Yank's red Mustang.
Hey, what's those lights down by the gates? It's a car. It's going towards the house. He's going round the back. It's probably the husband. Maybe we'd better move over.
No way. Just hang on.
He's going to do her in.
Oh, let me go. Rising up, you're shoving her in the car.
Let me go. door's still wide open.
Yeah. Let's go and have a quiet shifty. Here.
Come in, Joe. Well, there he is, mate. Lover boy's had it.
Is he dead?
Yes. You can see the break in the balustrade up there where he was shoved over. Right, let's go round the place and see what's cooking. Things locked.
This must be the main bedroom.
Bra and panties, look. He must have caught the masses. No wonder he was roughing her up.
Ah, here's his keys. Let's try the locked room. Yesu transceiver. Yeah, and there's the aerial down the side of the window. Right, let's have a look in the filing cabinet. Bottom drawer, empty. Second drawer, 5 blue file covers and contents. Top drawer. Beautiful. Two batches of one-time code pads with wrapping bands still around them. One loose pad missing 2 pages. Right, let's have a look at the files. Here, read that. Some chick from Santa Fe. Hot stuff, eh? Got girlfriends all around the world from the look of it. Chase Manhattan account, share certificates, bonds. Let's see the next one. My God. I wonder if Carter knew about this. He couldn't have.
What is it then, Mac?
Let's go, pal. I want to get on the blower to Carter.
He won't thank you for getting him out of Kipper 2 in the morning.
He will. He surely will. Now, take the radio down to the car and the code pads and, now that's the lot. I'll bring the files.
So, what's all the excitement about, Sonny Boy?
There's not going to be an inquest, according to the locals, because he's a Yank. They've notified his parents and they're coming over from San Antonio tomorrow.
Mm. So what's the rest of it? The files, I suppose.
There's 2 CIA men stashed away in this country.
2? For God's sake, 200's more like it.
I mean, 2 CIA men who are not on the list. Canadian passports, no contact with Grosvenor Square, I've never heard of either of them.
And what do you reckon they're doing here?
Hiding.
Who from?
Practically everybody.
Don't play games, boy. What's it all about?
They're both psychiatrists. They specialise in hypnotising, and they're both CIA agents.
So why the excitement?
Have you ever heard of the MK Ultra program?
No. What is it?
It's a CIA program about the use of special drugs and hypnosis to control somebody's mind. So that they do whatever they're told to do, but they never know what they've done, or even that they've done anything. They don't know that they were hypnotized at all.
Mm. Yeah, I heard a rumor about this 2 years, maybe 3 years ago. One of the Mossad boys was talking about it when he was in Tel Aviv. But how much truth is there in it?
It's 100% true. They've been doing it on scores of people for years.
You mean experimenting?
No. Actually doing it. Operationally.
Well, what sort of thing?
Everything from simple courier work to murder.
How can you be sure?
Well, it's in those files. Code names, the lot.
What are these guys doing here?
Like I said, hiding.
Who from?
the FBI, the CIA, several congressional committees and a few independent investigators.
Why should that bunch be after them? I mean, they're on their side, for God's sake.
Oh, that depends what you've been up to.
Like what, for instance?
Like hypnotizing people and using them as killers.
What, you mean they've actually done that?
Uh-huh. According to the files they have.
Well, better pass them to one of the evaluation teams.
What? And give up one of the best pieces of luck we've ever had? We could use those guys ourselves.
For what?
Knocking off some of the central council of the IRA, maybe? In Dublin? Either these two Americans cooperate with us, or we blow them.
Now you're cooking with gas, Sunbeam.
These two could do it for us.
And why should they?
So that we don't send copies of the files to the Washington Post and Reuters.
How definite is the file material?
Definite enough. Even as it stands, it would finish the CIA for good and all.
Where are the files?
At my place.
Well, you better go and get them. I'll come with you.
You'll use them, eh? You won't let them rot.
I'll think about it. Have you made copies of them?
No, not yet.
Right. Well, let's go and get them.
In the third episode of Pay Any Price by Ted Albury, you heard Barry Foster as Jimmy Boyd, Robert Beatty as Otto Schultz, Susanna Fellows as Debbie Shaw, and Michael J. Shannon as Tony Simmons. Lee Harvey Oswald and the CIA man were played by Ian Tyler, Jack Ruby by David Graham, Ziggy Grabowski by Kerry Francis, Peterson and the Interviewer by Danny Brainin, Katie by Carol Boyd, Nick Carter by James Kerry, McLaren by Crawford Logan, Sturgis by John Webb, Alexander by Eric Allen, the police officer by Nigel Graham, and the salesman and the reporter by Alex Jennings. The serial is directed by Christopher Venning.